language is important. If you've travelled to another country where English isn't spoken, you understand how comforting it is to slip back into your own language and not have to battle with another one. And in Australia, of course, we have many people for whom English is not their mother tongue. And sometimes I think we don't appreciate the difficulty faced by those people and the pleasure they must have in going back to their mother tongue when they're at home or talking to their parents or whatever. Language is really interesting. It's an important part of who you are. And I'm told that the Himalayas are a global centre for linguistic diversity. We can learn a lot there. And to learn a lot, we're going to talk with Gerald Roche. He's an anthropologist and senior research fellow at La Trobe University in the Department of Politics and Philosophy. Gerald Roche, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thanks, Amanda. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's fascinating, isn't it? A big place like the Himalayas, and you go to a place like Bhutan, small, and 21 indigenous languages. Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, look, the first thing is that the Himalayas is not as little as it appears on the map, perhaps. It really spreads out over a large area. So in many ways, the diversity that we find there shouldn't be all that surprising.
Mm. What's the story with linguistic diversity increasing in rough mountainous terrain? Is there a connection there, or is that just a passing reference in the article I've read?
Yeah, so look, the basic argument is that rough mountain terrain separates people and leads to divergence amongst their languages, so that people who don't talk to each other come to speak different languages over time, basically.
And why would they have in Bhutan a language as the national language, which isn't the one that's most widely spoken?
Right. Well, that issue gets to the heart of this problematic term minority and minority language. We think that a minority means that they're a small group, as the word implies, but actually what it means is a politically disempowered group. So the reason that Dzongkhar is the dominant language of Bhutan politically is that it was the language spoken by the politically dominant group, whereas the language which actually has the most speakers, Tsonglar, the speakers of that language never held political power in the country.
Well, that's interesting. And English, apparently, is widely spoken there, was described as Asia's most English-speaking country.
Yep, exactly. So it's a really important language in education. Most of the education there is in English or Dzongkhar. So there's been a deliberate attempt to sort of promote Bhutan's place in the international community, and English has been the way that that's done.
Mm. And is that also to take it a bit more out of regional politics?
Right. To some extent, it would seem that that's part of the reason, because until the 1960s and into the 1970s, Hindi was the language of education. So they were very much embedded into the region and connected more closely to India. And so I think it's reasonable to argue that the emphasis on English is really a little bit about distancing themselves from India. And so, you know, moving towards the international community, moving away a little bit from the local context.
What about neighbouring countries and the spread of language across borders? Because borders in themselves don't mean much, of course. You know, when I was in Italy, if you go up north, you can speak German in some towns. In fact, you go into a hotel and they speak German to you.
Yeah.
Why? Because they were once a part of Austria.
Exactly.
And they don't give a, you know, brass razoo about where the border is.
Yeah.
Their heritage is German and that's what they're going to speak.
Yeah. So I think for many of us in Australia, we're trained to think about languages and national borders as kind of things that go together. So, you know, the French language stops at the French border, the Swedish language stops at the Swedish border, and so on. I mean, first of all, that's not really even true in the European context, but in the Himalayan context, it's really not true. The languages really spread out across borders. The languages that you find that only exist in a single national context are very small languages, which are not really confined to one nation. They're confined to one village or one valley, if you like. So a lot of the languages in the region, so for example, Nepali spreads out across national borders, not only being spoken within Nepal, but also in Himalayan India and within Bhutan as well. The language that we were previously talking about in Bhutan, Tsonglar, is also spoken within India and inside China as well.
I'm talking with Gerald Roche. He's an anthropologist and senior research fellow at La Trobe University. And we're talking about the diversity of language, and in particular in the Himalayas. It must be very hard in places where there's such diversity of language to have a national language if that's used, for example, in the court system, and you're not a speaker of the designated national language. I mean, that's been a problem, for example, in Australia with Indigenous people who speak their own language predominantly, faced with an English court system, essentially. Yeah. It's a very baffling experience.
Right. So in the large Himalayan states, China and India, they both have kind of different ways of dealing with those languages in their policy frameworks and providing services like translation in the court and so on. So the basic distinction that I would make between how China and India deal with languages in the Himalayas and throughout the countries more generally is that one is a splitter and the other is a lumper. So China tends to group together small languages and define them as a single language, whereas India tends to break them up into smaller languages. And so what that means is that in a place like India, you have more fine-grained provision of services on the basis of language that people can actually understand. Whereas in China, when those services are provided, it's often in a language which is related to the language the person might speak, but may not necessarily be their language. So for example, in the context where I work with Tibetans, Tibetans speak a large number of languages, not just one Tibetan language. If you go to school as a Tibetan, if you're provided with a mother tongue education, it's in a single Tibetan language, not necessarily in the language that you speak at home.
Mm. I dislike seeing in the media examples of people self-immolating. Mm-hmm. But as I understand it, quite a lot of those people refer to their language rights as part of the reasoning for what they've done.
Yeah, that's true. So we had the 154th self-immolation just recently, unfortunately. So this is something which is still continuing to this day. And a number of those people have specifically mentioned language rights in the testimonies that they've left behind. And it's not just the self-immolation protests. There have been a number of other protests, street demonstrations, online petitions, and so on, around issues related to Tibetan language over the past decade or so.
Mm. Well, look, I just think this is fascinating. Apparently, Nepal's constitution recognises 123 languages, and Tibetans in China speak 16 different types of, or varieties, I suppose, is the word of Tibetan. Mm-hmm. And Tibetans have 26 non-Tibetan languages. How does one survive in this place? Does that mean that these people, it's not that they're linguistically diverse themselves, it's that they might speak two or three of these because of people they interact with?
So no, it's because they are diverse themselves, actually. And what it also meant is that amongst Tibetans, there was a high degree of multilingualism. So let's take an example from the region where I work, on the northeast Tibetan plateau. In one valley, which is about 25 kilometers long. Within that valley, you have at least four distinct languages being spoken natively to that area in different communities. And so what that means is that people will be dominant and fluent in their mother tongue in their village, but then they would know little bits and pieces of the languages spoken in the villages around them, and then they would have a better competence in the local dominant language, which is the local variety of Tibetan. So that means that it was really, multilingualism was an important way in which this diversity was maintained. It would be quite common, for example, to have people within a single household speaking two or three different languages as their mother tongues.
Mm, I wonder if they're good at music, because the theory is that if you learn music when you're young, you're much better at language. And I wonder if it works in reverse, that if you're good at languages, you've opened up the same neural pathways and are good at other things.
Well, the interesting thing in regards to music and language in the Tibetan context is that actually, even though people spoke a number of different languages, the shared common language of song was always Tibetan. So that I've called Tibetan in the past a singua franca rather than a lingua franca, meaning that people were more likely to be able to understand each other in song rather than in speech.
That's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. I have to say, Gerald Roche, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I'm not a linguist, so I'm very glad that I don't live in any of these places. But it is important that we understand the complexity of language, those of us who have the great luxury of speaking English. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Amanda.
That's it for this week. Next week, we start RN Summer, where we've picked out what we hope are the most interesting interviews this year. Join me then. Until next week, Amanda Vanstone saying ciao, ciao.